is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 85th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and today I actually have two gurus with me. I have Jim Routh. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
I'm good, and I have Scott Matsumoto. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Gary.
We are going to do something a little bit different for this episode of Silver Bullet. We'll moderate a mock debate and conversation between Scott and Jim on the topic of mobile security. So let me introduce the two guys that are participating. Jim Routh, until recently, was the global head of application security at JPMorgan Chase. He also served as an executive at DTCC and American Express, among other places. Jim is a well-known leader in security with particular interest in software security and mobile security. He's a member of the FSISAC board, and he lives in New Jersey with his wife, and he has a couple of boys who are both lacrosse stars. There are three of them, but I think there are two current lacrosse stars. Is that right? There's only one at Amherst. I think it's an entire lacrosse playing family. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Gary.
Scott Matsumoto is a principal consultant at Cigital, where he runs the mobile security practice. Scott has over 20 years of commercial software experience ranging all over the software landscape. He co-founded and was CTO of ExtremeSoft. He was CTO of Spring Street Networks, and he was also a development manager at Lotus a trillion years ago. Scott has a BA in physics from Lawrence University. He lives in Boston with his wife, plays a mean guitar, and has been known to dance ballet, but don't tell anybody. So, mobile security. The question at hand is mobile security really new and different, or is it the same old, all over again? So, of course, we're going to agree with each other in the end, but I want to, like, tease this apart as much as possible. Scott, let's start with you. You've been writing software for 20 years. How are the challenges of mobile security reminiscent of days gone by? You know, thinking about client server and web app stuff and so on.
Yeah, well, Gary, it's definitely an evolutionary change. You think about the internet applications going from the thin client browsers to RIAs. I mean, moving an application from a RIA to mobile is just the next evolutionary step. I mean, I use the analogy of a course curriculum. If web app security on a thin client is app security 101, RIAs are 201, and mobile security is 301. The analogy works because you are building on knowledge that you had before all along the way. And if the other part of it is that if you only read Cliff Notes to get through your finals on 101 and 201, you're going to be in a heap of hurt when you get into this class.
Well, I agree with that, Scott. You know, it seems like I think you say this, evolutionary, not revolutionary, in some sense. And many of the things that we've seen before trying to deal with a new kind of architecture is what we're seeing here. But I think there are some new threats in mobile security. Jim, you want to talk about what those new threats might be?
Sure. So I think actually there are aspects that make this technology evolutionary, no question about it. But as an information security professional, I spend a lot of time and effort educating application developers on what they need to be thinking about from a security standpoint with a mobile app that's different from a conventional web app. So obviously, if we're developing an Android app, we're using Java as a development platform. Java in conventional web is universal. Lots of people know Java. So a developer in a conventional web moves over to a mobile application development effort. The platform is similar or something that's known to them.
Uh-huh.
That's the goodness.
Yeah.
It's also the badness. The badness is they think, a developer would think, that if they just transfer their knowledge and context of a conventional web app to mobile app, they're home free.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, in the mobile platform, the distribution ecosystem is a threat, has a threat attack surface that has to be addressed.
I understand that, yeah. One example of that might be, believe it or not, mobile apps actually bring down tons more data than web apps do.
Yes.
And it all sits there on the phone, and the question is, well, who really has access to that phone?
Right.
So let's talk about maybe major threat categories in that space. We have malicious users, we got malicious devices, we've got attacker in the middle attacks all over the communications network, and then we got, you know, malicious applications themselves that came from somewhere else, all four to deal with. Scott, some of those sound familiar to me. I mean, can you talk about how those threats are present in past ecosystems that you've seen?
Yes, I think if we talk about malicious applications, I mean, malware, the thing that is the bane of existence of every administrator that administrates desktops, those are malicious apps. They're there. Certainly all these malicious websites that can come in and take care, you know, come in through your browser, take advantage of browser vulnerabilities. I think those exist both on a mobile device as well as on a desktop. I do think that there are pieces around the mobile, around mobility that do change that. And change the overall architectural security architecture in terms of the controls, but fundamentally, I think you still have many of the same threats. They just have a different face on them.
So I guess one example of that might be an attacker in the middle attack. So I guess on a phone, we have to worry about CDMA and GSM and Bluetooth and 802.11 and maybe on a web app there won't be quite so many channels, so we got to keep track of the new channels. And then we have the brand new near field communication thing and geolocation satellite data and accelerometers. So we're looking at an attacker in the middle, which we theoretically ought to understand, but we're looking at one who can get lots more places. And so that's the kind of the old and the new combined. I want to talk about attack surfaces a little bit. I just mentioned, you know, radios, new sorts of interfaces, USB interfaces, NFC. How do those impact the security situation, Jim?
Any technology that gives new features, functions, and capabilities, that's a good thing and something that will be used for convenience purposes, as well as that's a risk. It introduces another option, another vector for threat actors to exploit. And managing the complexity of the variables is what makes security a lot more challenging, because from a hacker perspective, you only need one way that's effective.
Right, right.
From a security perspective, you have to think about all of the different ways to mitigate multiple methods. And the more methods there are, the more complicated it is. And ultimately, the developer, the application developer, has to not only know and understand the technology, but has to understand how that technology can be used in a way not just to build functionality, but to exploit capability. For example, having one mobile application attack another mobile application.
Right. Well, we've seen that. I mean, you know, back in 1996 when we were writing malicious Java applets in the sandbox,
yes,
one of the things we did was attack the other applets. I mean, we were breaking the sandbox and we were hopping into somebody else's namespace, and the ultimate thing that we wanted to attack at that time was the security manager, because it had the keys to the kingdom, and as soon as you could confuse the Java virtual machine about what type is what, and say, oh, the new security policy has arrived, and it is anything goes.
Right.
You have that issue. I guess you can turn some of those things around, and you sort of alluded to this in your answer, which I think is spot on. Sometimes some of these capabilities can lead to security risks that we don't anticipate, but they are also capabilities which provide opportunities to do some new security thinking. And maybe we can turn those risks right upside down into security benefits. So, Scott, have you done any thinking about that and how that might work?
Yeah, I just a little bit. I think there are certainly areas in which we could take advantage of the device. I think one of the things that you can see where people are already doing is this technique called certificate pinning to take advantage of a native mobile application. They can create a much more tightly bound relationship between the client and the server. I also think that there is an opportunity to use some of the information around the sensors to figure out, you know, effectively what we'll start doing is change the way we do authentication, because we're going to want to use multiple factors, and we can see this happening already in the authentication space where we're trying to use various forms of data outside of just what you know, who you are, those basic ones. For example, we know several of our customers are using data from their security event management system to figure out, hey, this person's logging in from two different places at the same time.
Right. So you have new factors that you can put in, especially in fraud detection. I was just out at Stanford. I gave a talk last week, and it was hosted by Dan Bonet. They're doing some really incredibly cool work with the accelerometer. And the accelerometer can go both ways. It can, you know, it can locate you, it can fingerprint your walking style, and believe it or not, it can do voice recognition even though it's not a microphone, because it, you know, has 100 hertz sensing capability and your voice is in that range. So all of these things, when you put them together, you think, wow, that's either a security disaster or it's something that I should use to enhance security. And we always have to remember that those things cut in both directions. Yeah. So, Scott, one of the problems that we've always had in security for pretty much forever is that we over-rely on users to do smart stuff and to make good security decisions. And I think maybe we should follow the mantra, users say yes. No matter what. Or put another way, what Felton and I said in 1998 was, given the choice between dancing pigs and security, users will pick dancing pigs every time. So what are the dangers of native code access on mobile platforms, and what happens when a user says yes to the wrong stuff or screws up their security policy? And does that differ from the usual situation, or is it pretty much the same as it's always been, Scott?
I think the permission, certainly on Android, the permissioning model is very much in the way you've described it. And the users will give applications permissions because they have no idea what they're really granting. And so what effectively that does is it turns any application into a potentially malicious application, much more so than on, say, a PC, where the permissioning model is far less granular and doesn't rely on the users. So the risk is much greater on that particular platform.
Uh-huh. So we have to do maybe different things with some of our different capabilities because the risks have shifted a little. Jim, we're all pretty much done with this username and password stuff, and you alluded...
Yes.
To this idea of maybe enhancing authentication, or maybe that was Scott. You know, what can mobile platforms do to change the way we do authentication, change the way we do authent?
I think there's a hypothesis I'm working with right now that suggests that the mobile channel, which has a higher inherent risk profile than conventional web, largely because my device is very easy to lose, and
right.
therefore it gets in someone else's hands, and they can do things with it, like root it and then take credentials and use that for identity theft and fraud and other purposes.
Well, heck, people root their device on purpose. It's called, you know, I want to run something that Apple doesn't want me to run.
Right. And there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But the promise is that the residual risk could potentially be lower in the mobile channel versus conventional web, largely using relatively benign attribute information,
mm-hmm.
But when coupled together in a pattern, creates not only an identification of the device,
mm-hmm.
creates an identification of the user using the device. Now, you pointed out the accelerometer and the work that Dan is doing, and, and that's, you know, spot on, has tremendous potential. But really what that's doing is identifying behavioral attributes to identify the user. And from a fraud prevention and risk mitigation perspective, moving towards behavioral modeling, behavioral attributes is absolutely the right thing to do, and gives us much more granular way of identifying individuals.
I'm with you, but you know what? It reminds me of back in the ActiveX days when ActiveX first came out, and people said, well, I'm going to get all the way down to the guts of this machine and fingerprint the heck out of it and just, you know, take advantage of all the native sensors and all the log files that are built into this Windows box. Right. That was like circa 2000. And I think the bank guys were really pushing on that. Were you around for that, Scott? Do you remember that stuff?
No, I hate to say it, but that predates me in terms of security. I was one of the problem children actually creating security problems.
it predates your security. You're making me feel old, Scott.
But that was mostly register settings determining device characteristics.
That's right, yeah.
On the mobile platform, we can go well beyond the device to the user behavior.
Well, sort of. You're seeing the user behavior as filtered through a machine.
Yes.
And so you can think about it as, well, maybe that's raw data, but maybe actually the machine is trying to make me think what I want it to think. And that's a tricky, tricky thing.
Yes.
So I agree with you that sort of getting down and getting lots of good stuff is probably useful. And we can even do geolocation. Oh, look, that guy thinks he's located in two places on planet Earth at the same time.
Right.
I don't think so.
Right.
But we can also do standard fraud detection stuff that we've done for years. Why is this person transferring $500,000 to Ukraine when they've never done that before? In fact, there's a lawsuit now about that, as you know. You know, where some people said, well, we never did that before. And the bank said, well, you authenticated perfectly. So as far as we were concerned, it was you who did that.
Right.
And there are going to be arguments over that for years. I don't think that mobile is a panacea when it comes to that. And but I do think that we should take advantage of the new stuff. And I've coined this term trusted on busted to think about that. And the idea is that... I wrote this article and I invoked Descartes. You know, I was talking to John Stephen last night down here in Florida at FSISAC, and John Stephen said, only you would, you know, invoke something from 1625. But Descartes had this amazing idea that what if we're just a brain in a vat and there's some malicious demon that's feeding all the perfect inputs into our sensory apparatus? How would we ever know that we're a human or we're ourselves and not just a brain in the vat? And there really was no answer to that. There's still no answer to that metaphysical question. And in some sense, this notion of the hardware sort of being the ultimate thing doesn't let us escape from the brain in the vat problem. You know, it could always be, we could always have the device just lying to us with impunity about location, log files, voice prints, blah, blah. It would have to be darn sophisticated attack.
Well, that's really the point. What you're describing. That's hard.
That's right? Very, very hard, yeah.
Well, there are so many ways of exploitation today that are easy. So
why do that?
Why do the hard part?
Well, that's true, but if we say, if we accidentally think, oh, we have the solution, it's all going to be perfect from now on.
I don't think we have the solution. I think the premise here is that there are fundamental differences in the mobile platform from a security profile that have to be considered in the design of applications that are going to reside on that device.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally where
that's the deal, right, yeah.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening.
So, Scott, can you talk about the malicious demon thing a little bit and the idea of, you know, what happens when a device is rooted? And Does anybody know what the percentage of devices that are routed by their own carrier or routers or whatever licensees are?
Well, when that that website came out that jailbreaks iOS devices,
yeah.
I saw a number that was like 700,000 within the first 2 or 3 weeks. Right?
Well, how many millions of devices are there? So it might just be a small percentage. I don't know.
Well, it's growing, whatever it is.
Do you know, Scott? Have you come across any numbers?
I haven't seen a number, but by the data from all the people I talk to, when I say, oh, I'm working on mobile security, they're going, oh, you know how to jailbreak those devices?
So actually, is mobile get the hell out of security? Which is, I think, how users look at it.
What we're developing, what we have in place today, is an application wrapper capability that identifies whether the device is rooted or jailbroken. And to us, that's fundamental to knowing what the threat profile, the risk profile of that use case for that application, for that user, based on what we know.
Yeah, so you count that as sort of a black mark.
Yes.
Yeah, oops, yep. Rooted device.
Yep.
But that assumes that you can detect whether the device is rooted.
Yes.
And Scott, I think we've been trying to do rootkit detection and rooted device detection and whether, you know, privilege escalation, attack detection for years. How's that going out there in the battles?
Well, you know, I think that, and you know, on these phones, I think the goal was to create a great phone, not to create a trusted computing platform.
Uh-huh.
And so some of the fundamental pieces, you know, of a trusted computing platform aren't in most phones.
Actually, I think they are in the phones. They're just not exposed right now. So I know that most phones have, a little trusted coprocessor, and often it's used to make sure that the charger and the cord is right, so they can charge you $35 for that.
Well, right, and there are trusted chips in some of these NFC-enabled devices, but those pieces of the trusted platform aren't available to general applications.
I see. So even though the apparatus is there, we're not using it today.
We can't, right? Because there's no economic. We're not allowed to, or there's no economic model to enable their use. So, I mean, that's kind of one of the problems, you know. And I think even without a trusted computing platform, I think along to Jim's point that we can raise the bar. I think if we look at what the online gaming folks have been doing.
Uh-huh.
They've been building not trusted clients, but they have a bunch of techniques in terms of, sending information back from the client, you know, disguising it, sending red herrings. There are a lot of techniques that we could learn from, you know, these types of applications to be brought towards a mobile platform to give us, for a general application, the notion that we have more trust, you know, in the application. I agree with you, Gary, that, you know, the fact that we have, that there's jailbreak detection code in an application, that can certainly be subverted. It's based on some heuristics. Again, it's going to be, it's better than no detection, but once if there's a large enough value in terms of the asset that the application has access to, the attacker is going to figure that out.
Yeah, you can sort of expect that as part of the deal.
I agree with Scott completely, and I think that there are opportunities to look at what's being done in the gaming industry that will mimic mainstream mobile application distribution in the future.
I can't imagine that. I mean, who would ever write something on exploiting games and what that has to do with the future?
You know, I remember reading a book about that. I can't remember who wrote that book, but I'm sure they were very wise at the time. But the point is that an application developer in a mobile app has to decide whether or how much to make their code harder to reverse engineer,
yeah,
and therefore tamper with.
Well, there's another thing you can do other than just make it tamper resistant. You can also take state information and compute like a low resolution vector over that. And at the server side, you can go, oh, look, the thing just went orthogonal on us, so let's start paying more attention to that. And you can crank up your security apparatus in real time based on some of that state information. We see that sort of thing. The game guys have been doing that for a while, although not in as sophisticated a sense as we want. But since you guys have vast amounts of data, in both the financial services industry and in the insurance industry, where the whole idea is we got more data than you, so we know the math. That's something that we can take advantage of. If we mine those data and we're able to predict what's normal, and then we can just have a baseline and we can say abnormal's happening, so crank down the cranks.
Yeah, actually, what you're describing is a model that I think is going to change the way we think about authentication in the defining gray at a granular level is what we're pursuing, as opposed to is it black or white.
Yeah.
And all of our authentication controls in the enterprise today are based on let them in, don't let them in.
Yeah,
it's binary.
It's the Bell and LaPadula model. And as you and I both know, it scales badly on all fronts. Like, how many employees do you have? 180,000? Holy cow, that's a lot of entries in the actor table. And they each have five things? Uh-oh. You know, that's a lot of entries. Now, how many things can they touch? Oh, my goodness, 400 million? Uh-oh. That's a hell of a table of yes and no's. And I think that that model broke down long, long ago. We tried to fix it with role-based access control. That didn't really work. We tried to fix it with entitlement systems. That didn't really work. So maybe some of these new ways of computing identity on the fly through behavior will help. I'm not sure that that's entirely just a mobile thing. No, I just think that's a thing. And a lot of people have thought about that thing for some number of years.
Well, I think I agree. I think the difference is mobile gives you more attributes to work with.
It might.
Because it's a
because it's all in one package.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's more in near to us than our wallet. So, 19 to 29 year olds, 90% of them sleep with their device, their cell phone, within 5 feet of themselves. Right? And
so I thought you meant something.
I know you did. That's the way your mind works. Right?
So, I want to talk about the dangers of this situation. So in some sense, if we can pinpoint identity, and even if we do it through a trusted computing approach, there are severe privacy trade-offs. We have to decide as consumers whether that's something we want to do. Ross Anderson's written extensively about, you know, trusted computing on the chipsets in PCs. And by the way, all of your laptops have that trusted computing stuff built in. It's just not on right now. And so, Scott, you've probably seen this war raging for 10, 15 years. What are your thoughts about how mobile will impact that? Do you think the trusted computing people will finally get some uptake because of mobile security issues?
I think so. I mean, we've been talking to some of the manufacturers, and they've realized that their devices are indeed computing platforms, and they're moving in that direction. I think industry-wide, you can see things like, you know, the secure Android movement. I think that's going to be very, very important to help provide us a better platform to work on. I'm not following what's going on in the Apple world in that area, but I think that Android is certainly a big part of the market, and they're moving in that direction. So I think we should be looking at that and looking at these different at the sort of the next level of isolation, where you have either a trusted coprocessor, or a trusted OS with an application OS like in SE Android. I think that's really where we want to be focusing some of the efforts for applications that inherently are protecting.
What do you think about the privacy implications and the computational liberty implications? Does that worry you, or are you just psyched about being able to solve some of these problems?
I'm really just worried. I'm not worried about privacy. Sorry about that, Gary.
It's good news for you, Jim.
Well, I think what you're suggesting is that the technology capabilities far outstrip our privacy norms and expectations, and that's absolutely correct. Uh-huh. And so, on the mobile platform, we've looked at all of the attribute information that we get both on the device and the potential user of the device. Mm-hmm. And what we've determined is about out of 70 primary attributes, 20 of them we discard simply because we're not comfortable using that from a privacy perspective. Now,
right.
An example would be looking at a web browsing history. Whether that's conventional web or mobile, it's really the same.
I gotta tell you, the game guys have been doing that for years.
Know,
they're
yeah.
like, "What? You're on that cheating website? Okay, well, you're banned."
Yeah. Right. But that's a a line we're not gonna cross.
That, right.
Looking at contact history.
But it's you're not gonna cross it because you don't feel like
we choose
it.
Not to.
Like nobody said you better not cross that line.
No. Well, I got our legal and privacy folks to review all of the attributes,
uh-huh.
and we identified the ones that we're comfortable using,
right.
which are relatively benign, but when you put them together, are clearly effective.
Right,
and,
right.
And so that's kind of where we've determined the sweet spot. But the point is, the technology gives you ample opportunity to cross that line, and you have to figure out where your line is, and that's every organization has to do that.
Yeah, and when you get down to the trusted coprocessor, and you start really doing trusted computing, in the way that it was dreamed up long ago,
right?
Then you have sort of the ultimate little piece of trust you're starting with, but it's also the ultimate identifier.
Yes.
That is very, you can't unforge it, it's cryptographically secure, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so we do have to think about those things as we just rush towards the future. Let's talk a little bit about something more benign, or something more banal. You've been doing standard issue web application security for approximately as long as the web has been around, and I know you guys have seen web attacks like crazy at JPMorgan Chase and other places. So what worry do we need to have about those kind of standard issue, run-of-the-mill, same old 101 attacks on mobile platforms?
Well, actually, we're seeing potential risk. Not so much today, but what we're projecting in the future is dealing with privacy, but privacy in terms of using capability for spying and espionage.
Oh, yeah.
And the ubiquitous nature of a mobile platform being in your pocket, on your person, wherever you're going.
Well, you've probably been to the places where they make you stick your cell phone in a
yes.
lead box.
Yes.
And then, you can have this at the end of
yes.
the day and the battery's dead by the time
yes.
you get it. God knows what they did to it.
Yes. Yes.
We might see more of that in the future.
We will see more of that in the future.
Yeah, so you go to the bank and they're like, check your cell phone here.
Right. Actually, there's a little test that your listeners can do right off the bat. Do a Google search on mobile spyware.
Uh-huh.
What you will find is that the first 25 hits are all companies selling a capability to allow you to spy on other people.
Well, mostly your spouse.
Yeah, mostly your spouse. That's
I think, or maybe your teenagers.
Yeah, both. So those near and dear to you, you can now spy on them.
So Scott, Mr. No Privacy, when you had teenagers running around, did you track them through the web?
Yeah.
What?
We actually didn't track them. My wife and I kind of feel that that's part of being a parent and teaching them about about how to protect their own privacy.
Yeah.
And my wife has succeeded in raising two girls that are as paranoid as most as anyone could be.
Congratulations,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
My older daughter knows how to use every feature of the Facebook authorization model. And has her 1,000 1,000 friends completely partitioned, so and complains when they change it. So that's the.
Yeah, my son Jack has multiple identities. I started following one of his many Twitter accounts one day, and he said, "Dad, you can't follow this account. You're outing me." It's like you just connected me with Google. I was like, "Oh, damn, I did. Sorry, Jack." the network of people who watch is tight. That's been a fascinating conversation. Obviously, this is a very tricky and complicated issue when it comes down to it, and it gives us an opportunity to rethink some of these security issues that we've been faced with for years and years. But I want to boil this down to the ultimate question. So, Jim, you're first. Mobile security, really new and different, or same old?
New and different.
Yep. Scott, new and different, same old, same old.
I think it's evolutionary, and if you didn't involve, you're going to be in a heap of hurt to get there.
Right. So I'm thinking evolutionary, not revolutionary. But certainly lots of That's the reason we're doing computer security is because it's always interesting. Okay, that's it. Thanks, you guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary.
So this has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, syndicated by Search Security. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P features special coverage of technology transfer, as well as our interview with Steve Belevin, who is currently the CTO of the Federal Trade Commission, doing very interesting things in software security. If you don't know about that, you should check it out. For more, see www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.